On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with cult expert Joe Zimmert.
We can fall on the side of explain it away with materialistic science, or we can look at the explanations that you're talking about, and we know that they can lead to some really harmful behavior in terms of associating those experiences or sorting them into a certain way that people want us to. So that really is the challenge, isn't it? I mean, from your experience, what do we do then with these experiences?
The key words are stop and think. That's something that people don't want to do with it, because to break it down and think about it and analyze it, you know, you tend to lose what it is. Cults tend to tell people that the only thing between you and God is your head. My contention is that if that experience is real, as one feels it is, it's not going to go away upon analysis. You're not analyzing the experience per se, because it is what it is. You're analyzing the context. One thing that I look at with people when I work with them is, you know, is there something called mystical manipulation going on?
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I have an interesting interview with cult expert Joe Zimmert. It's an interesting interview that took a couple of unexpected turns, but that's often what makes these dialogues so fascinating. Here's the interview. Today we welcome Joe Zimmert to Skeptico. Joe is an expert on cults and has been counseling, lecturing, and helping people with cult-related issues since breaking away from a New Age sect in the 1980s. Joe, welcome to Skeptico.
Hi, yeah, I'm glad to be on. Thanks.
Well, I'm just really excited to have you on. It's a totally different topic than anything we've talked about before, but it's just fascinating to me in so many different ways, and it touches on so many of the things that we've talked about in a rather strange way. It leads back to some of the conversations we've had with some of the leading researchers and scientists on human consciousness. But, you know, I first ran across your name and your work, if you will, when I was researching J.Z. Knight, the leader of the Rampa School of Enlightenment and the person behind that super popular New Age science movie from a few years ago, What the Bleep Do We Know? Can you tell folks a little bit about your interview that is on your website with Jeff Knight?
Yeah. Jeff, of course, was J.Z.'s third husband, I believe. But in any case, he met her around 1980 when he was a young equestrian and was selling a horse, and she was buying a horse. And at the time, she had just got on the market in the West Coast, especially with channeling this entity that she claimed she met in 1977. And she was doing these sessions in Richard Chamberlain's living room at the time, and a lot of notables in the area and some movie stars came to experience her channeling Rampa and have Rampa talk to them. And she invited Jeff to this, and Rampa and Jay-Z told Jeff that Jay-Z and him were soulmates and that they were the destiny between them. And Jeff never seen anything like this, and he got swept up in the movement and was, you know, on the front stage for quite a few years with her until they divorced in 1987. And so I got to know Jeff, and we talked quite a bit, and, you know, and I interviewed him one of the times I was out in the West Coast a few years before he died. He had contracted AIDS. He was openly gay all his life, in fact, but confused about that issue when he was married to Jay-Z Knight.
And what the video reveals is just striking and very damning for Jay-Z Knight and the Romp, the School of Enlightenment, right?
Yeah. As a forward, as an exit counselor or someone who examines cultic organizations, you know, I look for levels of harm or good. I mean, there are such things as good cultic formations in human society. These things have been around for, you know, probably as long as we've been a social a creature called human. But, you know, the way to examine, the way I examine these groups is according to the knowledge or the belief system according to the conduct of the leader and the members, or their behavior, and then again according to governance. How do they govern themselves, and how does that governance affect the society around them? You know, and so you look at those ways of expression, and then determine whether, you know, what level of harm is being done and to whom. As far as addressing the What the Bleep movie, I would put you know, what you call science in that movie in quotation marks. It's a form of knowledge, but not necessarily knowledge that passes the scientific method test. There's a lot of eccentric and paranormal claims in that film, What the Bleep Do We Know? It was produced and put together by Ramtha followers, which was unknown to many people that saw the group, and they wondered who this weird lady was that was on the show. Some people had no idea who Ramtha was when Jay-Z appeared as Ramtha on the show answering questions.
Let me pull you back, though, if I could, for 1 minute, because
sure.
This Jeff Knight thing I thought was, I just really wanted to kind of nail that down for a minute in terms of the Ramtha School of Enlightenment and Jay-Z Knight, and folks who aren't familiar with it, he has two or three points that I think are just particularly damning against the idea that Jay-Z Knight is for real.
One of the things that Jeff expresses in that interview is what Irving Goffman, E-R-V-I-N-G, Goffman, states as backstage reality when you study groups. You can't just take a group face value by reading their brochures and talking to members that say it's a great experience and please come to our show. In any kind of theater like that, and I look at cults that we call cults in or these social gatherings that are eccentric in our society, a form of theater. And as Goffman points out, there's always a backstage reality that the average public and the average reporter isn't going to see. And that also that the average member and also the leader of the group doesn't want people to find out. But Jeff was backstage with Jay-Z, and that's what he talks about in his interview. He saw her, for instance, reading books that later came out of the, you know, when she's channeling Ramtha. The information's coming from Ramtha now. He had experienced her channeling other entities. For instance, an entity named Charles from the 19th century, who knew about horses supposedly and would channel information. No one following the group knew that Jay-Z did that sort of thing privately. There's a host of things about her behavior regarding money and the greed, that kind of thing, which sort of fleshes out what was going on, and especially for him. Now, we have to ask the question, why did he stay in so long when he saw this was going on? Well, he did what most group members do in any kind of good or bad, is that they justify why they are there. They learn to rationalize the system despite this confirmation of their beliefs and facts within the system from the outside or from ex-members. And, you know, this is called cognitive dissonance. When we have a strong belief, it's much more painful to change that belief than to keep it. And so we tend to justify our beliefs. And the ironic thing is, the more intelligent we are inside one of these groups, once we've adapted, once we've contracted with our souls to follow or devote ourselves to a path, that intelligence can actually keep us in a group. You can find more reasons to stay in other words. Our arguments become more strict and more boxed in. So you know, the human mind is quite flexible, but once it's put into a particular kind of belief system, it's called brainwashed or under a form of mind control. And mind control is nothing more than policing our own thoughts. And that's exactly what Jeff was doing all those years, even though he saw things that were wrong. It took stepping outside the group, meeting someone outside the group, reading information outside the group that stretched his mind again, stretched it to the point where it no longer fit within the constricted views that he had, and the rationalization melted away, and he became a much healthier, reasonable human being as a result of that. It could make a decision as to whether that was real or not, and he decided it was not real. anymore. I don't know if that helps, but that's how I explain that.
Well, I think that's great. The one point in there that I was fishing for, because it really struck me, is the financial part of it. Here's a guy who was an expert in horses, that being Jeff, and he saw Rompha using him to acquire horses, and then she'd resell them after suckering people in with this idea that she had read that this horse was a reincarnation of some great noble, I don't know if it was a noble horse or a noble warrior or something like that, but yeah. It's purely and just a rather transparent scam deal to kind of make money, and that's something that he had particular expertise in and could see through.
Right. I mean, Jeff was able to show, once he woke up from the whole thing, and it is like waking up from a spell of sorts, like, Dorothy clicking her heels and coming back from the land of Oz. He knew that the only horse that had any value throughout that whole thing was one that he picked, not Rompha. The horses that Rompha picked, according to the Arabian horse market, which knows horses, weren't that valuable. And yet some of these people were paying 10, 20 times as much as the horse was worth, who Rompha matched up with the horse. That was what the scam was about, and that's why there was a cease and desist order issued by the state of Washington for her to stop using Rompha to sell horses.
Right. And again, there's just so much to pull apart, but let me get into the stuff that I really find most interesting and most challenging, because I think it cuts both ways. And as we were talking about a minute ago, my initial interest in this was not at all cult, about the cult or about Jay-Z Knight. I didn't even know who she was. I was just interested in some of the ideas of the scientists, and that was my angle. And from that, I guess I branched off into becoming interested about this interaction between science and spirituality. And I think it's something that you touched on, which I find just fascinating. And that's that, we have to acknowledge that people do have these profound spiritual experiences. And then at the same time, they're trying to make sense of these spiritual experiences in our ordinary world, and that can really kind of create some problems, can it? And it can also, even more so, it can open them up to, if there's someone who helped facilitate those spiritual experiences, it can certainly open them up to believing whatever else that person says, because they see them as the person who brought that spiritual experience to them. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've seen in that area?
Yeah. In terms of harmful cults, what we call harmful, or end up looking harmful after some time, let me back up. A lot of the Bible sects out there, and New Age groups, and others, mass therapy type groups, they somehow get people to experience, something in the organization. It could be through a meditation technique, it could be through chanting, it could be through group dynamics. But in any case, people have some kind of an aha experience or a dream, or they feel the Holy Spirit, or they get a chill up their spine and think it's the Kundalini acting. All kinds of things can happen during these extraordinary events, and they seem mystical, and they are very personal. Now, if you go back to William James, there is nothing wrong with an experience like that. It is what it is, and you have to go from the experience when you examine it. You can't say it doesn't exist. You can't say it has no value, because it certainly does. But then you have to ask, what next? What's happening next after that? What's the behavior? And as many researchers have pointed out, including I.M. Lewis in his book Ecstatic Religion, and his study on shamanism, he shows that when a person has an ecstatic experience, they will immediately look to their social environment or their immediate environment to make sense of it. And that's where the so-called influence begins to take place. If I was someone who went to Lourdes, for instance, in France, and went to the Holy Shrine, a Catholic shrine there, and had a healing experience, well, I'm going to turn to the Catholic Church, probably, to help me answer the questions I have about this mysterious event that took place, right, even if I'm not Catholic. If I am sitting in a channeling session by some entity, and suddenly I feel golden light around me, and I feel more at peace and universal than I ever had in my whole life, I'm going to apply that experience to that group and begin to sort out how I can continue that, because I don't want to lose my experience.
Right.
So that's generally how this works. The same thing if you're in a tent meeting and there's a Bible revival going on and you suddenly feel whatever they're talking about as the Holy Spirit, you will identify yourself with that group. That's a marker in someone's life, and it's inexplicable. We can call it endorphins. We can call it.
But wait, before we call it endorphins or anything else, I think we're now at the crux of the issue, because we can call it endorphins and we can fall on the side of explain it away with materialistic science, which if we really look at the explanations there, they don't really hold up very well either. Or we can look at the explanations that you're talking about, and we know that they can lead to some really unfortunate and harmful behavior in terms of associating those experiences or sorting them into a certain way that people want us to. So that really is the challenge, isn't it? I mean, from your experience,
yeah.
What do we do then with these experiences?
The key words are stop and think. That's something that people don't want to do with it, because to break it down and think about it and analyze it, you know, you tend to lose what it is. It's like, you know, taking a very interesting insect that you see in nature and watching it and enjoying it, and then taking it into the lab and pinning it down and chloroforming it and taking it apart. Well, you've lost the insect. You've lost the experience. And that's what people are afraid of when you think too much about these things. The cults tend to tell people that the only thing between you and God is your head, or, you know, between your heart and God is your head. And they also use the words like the monkey mind will get in the way. It'll keep jumping around and analyzing things and won't stay still long enough to really take in the wholeness of the experience and so forth. My contention is that if that experience is real, as one feels it is, it's not going to go away upon analysis. In fact, it can be strengthened if the analysis holds up the context of the experience. And that's what you're actually analyzing. You're not analyzing the experience per se, because it is what it is. You're analyzing the context. One thing that I look at with people when I work with them is, you know, is there something called mystical manipulation going on? You know, can this type of experience be engineered? You know, are you a highly suggestible subject that can have these kind of experiences induced by the environment? You know, all these questions come up.
Those are certainly interesting questions to contextualize, like you're saying, the experience. But let me back up here, because I'm not sure that we're on the same page about the experience itself, because that's what we've really focused on a lot here. And I want to make it clear, at least where I'm coming from, because I've found another side to this, another angle, which is there's a strong pull on the side of the scientific and just our cultural norms to explain away these experiences, even in the face of kind of overwhelming scientific data. And the one that we talk about most on here, because it's easiest to talk about and easiest to get at the data, is the near-death experience, because it's been verified, it's been published in every medical journal, from the New England Journal of Medicine to the Journal of Psychiatry and Psychology, just every, and it's widely accepted that it is a genuine, unexplainable, in our current medical knowledge, experience. And once we get past that hurdle, then we have to accept that these people who are experiencing this, they do have all the characteristics that we would identify with a spiritual experience. It transforms them. It's meaningful. It connects them with this higher power, da-da-da-da. And all that is just a way of saying, I want to make sure that you're not denying or trying to explain away that people are having these spiritual experiences without regard to what they mean or what they are, or analyzing, which I'm all for. But do you believe there is such a thing as a genuine spiritual experience?
Yes, to put it in one word. And to back that up, I've had them myself. and to back it up even further, I'm a practicing Catholic. Now, a lot of people are very surprised when they hear that about me, but you know, I was born into the faith. I left it for 20 years and I reentered it. And then people ask why, you know, how could you do that? Look at that church, look at its history. Well, I have looked at its history and I understand all that's wrong with it. I don't deny any of that. But a Catholic, you know, has certain beliefs and miracles and all that sort of thing. And the communion of saints and there's plenty of Catholic, like in any religion, in fact, whether it's Buddhist, Catholic or Protestant, testimonials of experiences with beings on the other side. You know, Mormons, for instance, one of their ways of proving their faith is to have a testimonial or a witness that they've been visited by an ancestor, like a ghost, you know, of a grandmother or someone who died or some great figure in the church. That gives them their proof. That's their proof that their religion is real because, you know, obviously under analysis, when you look at it historically, it really looks pretty thin, the evidence that Joseph Smith ever found golden plates and translated those things. You know, that part doesn't hold up, but the experiential part does for the Mormon.
But Joe, and you kind of led me right into the Roman Catholic thing with you, and I think it is surprising, and I guess I am going to have to push you a little bit on that to explain it, because you seem to me to offer up the same contradiction that we're talking about. Right, Mormonism, in terms of its historical accuracy, it's just ridiculous. It doesn't hold up to common sense.
Especially if you watch the South Park episodes of when they look at the Mormon faith.
Yeah, they do.
And they're quite accurate, actually.
They are. So. Dumb. But,
and the same when they look at Catholic faith. They're quite accurate about a lot of what goes on in there.
Right. So why would you offer up to us this strange little tidbit that you did in there, that as a Catholic, it's an article of faith, blank, fill in the blank. Why would any of us rational, logical people, and I'm a believer in spirit and spiritual experiences, as are you, but I don't take anything on an article of faith that since I'm in this group, since I'm called myself whatever, I therefore have to believe these things. Why wouldn't we want proof in whatever way we determine proof being meaningful for us? Why wouldn't we want proof of anything we believe?
Well, because we get in trouble when we believe false ideas or false experiences, and there are such things as false, you know, in the sense you know, I could tell any number of stories of people I've met who had incredibly powerful experiences, let's say with someone like Sri Chinmoy when he was alive. You know, he was well known as a East Coast guru with a lot of heavyweight followers and in his time. But after they'd leave him or after they got to know him and left him, they could see that their experience, you know, in other words, they had to reevaluate that powerful experience they had with him in another world or the holy feeling they had around him. And it sets into question all experiences like that for an ex-member. So they struggle with this sort of thing that we're talking about now. When you leave a group like that, can you ever again believe in what is a holy experience or you know, join something like the Catholic Church, which is filled with all this kind of stuff? Well, you know, my answer is yes, you can, but you're not going to be the same person you were when you were naive about that sort of thing and didn't know how to contextualize it or how to work with it in terms of the context you're in. And even within the context, let's say within the Catholic Church or any church, how far do you carry that belief? How far will you let that organization carry you based on that belief? You know, where do you draw the line? I mean, these are difficult questions. They are what I call adult questions. These are what happens when we mature in a faith. We become adults in those faiths, and we're a lot more careful about, you know, being led around by other people's experiences or by some doctrine or dogma. You know, being involved in Catholicism, I mean, I have to be very agile. And in fact, you know, some of my approaches, my personal approach to Catholicism could border on heresy. I don't know. You know, so it's very difficult. It's not easy. It's an adult problem. You know, there's no clear absolute answers to this, and whether you're Catholic or not.
But why, I guess, again, I come back to the question, why do we need that group? And let's make it personal. Why do you need that group? Why do you need Roman Catholicism as a label for whatever it is you believe. Aren't you to a certain extent falling into the same problems that we have with groups? And I think, as you mentioned before, there's a lot of good things that come out of groups and our association and all that. But why do these groups have such power over us? And why does Catholicism draw you in when you really kind of know there's some hypocritical, contradictory, unresolvable issues with the doctrine and the dogma?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you can broaden the whole question to Christianity in general.
Because, I would.
A lot of people would. And you know, was there ever a virgin that had a God child? Was that borrowed from some kind of a pagan myth and inserted into the Jewish experience that Jesus ever lived?
Well, at the very least, I mean, let's just touch on that. It was certainly a repetition of a myth that had happened over and over again. Some Christians will tell you, well, that doesn't mean just because it was a myth before, it wasn't real here. But as rational, logical human beings, we can say it certainly casts a lot of doubt on that, especially.
Well, let me add some history to this. What you're reacting to, and what a lot of people react to today, because we're modernists, we're in the scientific age, we react to what's called fundamentalism in religion. And fundamentalism in religion is only 100-some years old. It really emerged in the late 18th and 19th centuries as a reaction to modernism and to the need for the scientific method, for scientific proof, which began to challenge religion. And if we look at our modern age, a lot of the modern religions, including theosophy, Christian Science, Church of Religious Science, Science of the Mind, Scientology, it goes on and on, and the fundamentalists in Christianity and in Islam and the fundamentalists in Hinduism, they want to claim that their beliefs are as scientific, as true, and as absolute as the laws we find in science. So that's the great error. These things are mysterious and they remain mysterious. We don't have to.
Why would we want them to remain mysterious?
Because they are. There is no science to be able to test it. I mean, a scientist will tell you that if you have extraordinary claims, we need extraordinary evidence to test it. If there's no extraordinary evidence, you have a mystery. And it's not in the realm of science to even worry about something like that. That's in some other, we call it religion.
No, I just don't agree, and I don't think we share that common understanding of science. Science is a set of tools. It's not a position statement. We don't draw lines in the sand, and that's what's the problem with that oft-repeated quote, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. Of course they don't. That's completely unscientific because it adds a subjective measure. I could always claim that your claims are extraordinary. My claims are not. My proof is extraordinary. Your claims are not. Science is about trying to bring some objective measures to these things, but it's still just a game. It's just a tool. We don't wind up with any truth. We just wind up...
Well, let me stop you right there. I understand where you're going with this because I've been through these arguments before, and I've read Dawkins' books and all that sort of thing about these issues. And I'm a member of the Skeptical Inquiry organization. I get to have gotten their magazine. I helped set up a skeptics group in New Mexico when it first formed with Ken Frazier.
I didn't know that. I feel for you.
So I'm aware of all this kind of argument, but going back to Catholicism, there is more. Despite everything else, everything that people see about the Catholic Church, there is more rigor in examining supernatural events in the Catholic Church and in any other religious organization that I found. I mean, there has been a lot of priests and clerics that have been scientists. Father Lemaître was the mathematician that convinced Einstein of the theory of singularity, from a mathematical point of view. He was a priest, a practicing priest, and yet he was a very strict mathematician. He argued to the Pope's people not to use that scientific evidence to prove their religion. He says, you can't do that.
Again, boy, you kind of threw me for a loop here when we're talking about Catholicism, and next you're telling me that you're also a skeptic. I don't know how you square those things. I'll tell you a little bit about my journey here on this show, and I'll tie it back to the what the bleep, because when I first brought up the scientist, you were quick to jump in there and say, put those scientist names in quotes and put the whole idea.
No, I was talking about the movie, the What the Bleep movie, because I don't see any science in that film.
Well, of course there is. I mean, one of the guys we've interviewed from that who's in that movie is Dean Radin, and he's an extremely, extremely highly regarded scientist who's explored these controversial topics like precognition and telepathy and the Ganzfeld experiment. But he's very a rigorous guy. He used to work at Stanford Research Institute. Was a professor for a long time. And those are the kind of people we've talked to a lot. And what we've found is that there is this skeptical side, this group that you're familiar with, who uses the reverse of these tools that you're talking about to deny the any kind of scientific reality that comes out, to hold to a particular worldview in the same way that you see on the other side in terms of what cults do. And I'm not calling skeptics cults, because there's so many groups that are cultish. But what I think is interesting, and I just really want to pull this apart with you, because all this stuff, we'll never get to all of it. We'd have a four-hour discussion that no one would be that interested in listening to except for me. But I want to get back to the blade of the sword and how we fall on either side, because we do have these spiritual experiences. And on one side, we have this group that is going to be strongly, strongly, because I've run into them, inclined to deny and explain away that experience in the most ordinary terms. It couldn't have happened. And on that same side are many, many Christian and other religious people who will also deny that experience because it doesn't fit within their doctrine and dogma. So they'll say, yes, miracles can happen. Back 2,000 years ago when Jesus was here. Yes, you can go to heaven and see God and Jesus. 2,000 years ago, or only in this context, only if you see these certain things. And I've had guests on who said exactly that, have said the near-death experience can't be true because it doesn't conform to what the Bible says you'll see in heaven. And this whole way of thinking is really, I think, troublesome to me, because it doesn't give us any chance to really understand and analyze, as you're talking about, the spiritual experience. But then if we fall on the other side of the sword that cuts this issue, we get into this other area that you've dealt with so much, and that's with the cultish New Age, not always New Age, but a set of beliefs that someone attaches to that experience, and then that can lead to some very destructive behavior, whether that person sees it or not. So I don't know where the question is in there, but that's what I want to get back to talking about, is how we figure out and how we have one foot in both worlds, in one, accepting that spiritual experience for whatever it is, and also trying to bring it back and make it make sense in our real day-to-day life.
Well, let me put this more in pedestrian terms, because I get asked this question nearly by everyone where I've had a successful intervention, you know, where I've able to, which is about 60% of the people I've met in these circumstances will end up leaving the group while I'm talking to them. And I invariably get asked, okay, if that's not true, in other words, if Ramtha is not true or Scientology is not true or whatever, then they look at me and say, well, what is true? You seem to know so much. What's truth? and I look back at them and I say, well, first of all, you're asking the wrong question.
What are your questions?
Well, the ones I continue to ask. I mean, I still question the core beliefs of Christianity.
What I was really asking there is, when you said you counsel folks and you say, if you're going to ask those big, huge questions, those unanswerable questions, maybe those are not the right questions.
They're not the right questions to start with, right? You shouldn't start with those questions.
What are the questions you think that folks should start with?
Well, you begin with the self, you know, and after someone leaves a cult like that, they tend to be somewhat confused. And so you look at yourself and you say, well, I'm kind of confused. I feel lost. Okay. You know, what did you like about the group? What got you into it? And so you start examining that. The reality around us that we see, that we perceive, our perception, there's an interaction, and it will shape around us in some way. We will begin picking up cues in the environment that reinforce our new direction. And, you know, we will see coincidences happening. For instance, in that book, the Celestine Prophecy, which was really famous 15 years ago. Do you know which one I mean?
Of course. But yeah.
He calls them insights or whatever that was happening to him, and in a way, a lot of people identified with that book, even though the book was a farce. In my estimation, I reviewed it for the Skeptical Inquirer. The people will believe.
What are you
in that
doing, messing around with the Skeptical Inquirer? They do not believe there is any such thing as a spiritual experience. To me, we keep kind of dancing around. And I understand where you're coming from because I think, you provide in the videos that I've seen, you have an amazing sensitivity and ability to work with people, and at the same time stick to your message, stick to your agenda, and communicate information that's helpful to people. I think you're extremely talented at what you do, and I haven't had a lot of exposure to exit counselors, but you're just fantastic. But in terms of this discussion we're having, Joe, we keep kind of bouncing back in terms of the kind of modern psychology in terms of how you can recover, which I know is your thing and the people that you deal with, and the underlying reality. I mean, if there is a spiritual reality, I mean, so the work that I've done, the science that I've explored with the top scientists, medical doctors, Pin Van Lommel worked 25 years in a hospital in the Netherlands, you know, Jeff Long, a radiation oncologist in Louisiana who studied near-death experience. So the conclusion is, from that, scientifically, medically, consciousness survives death in some way we don't understand, okay? That's a scientific fact as much as any other scientific fact we have. Now, the Skeptical Inquirer people do not go there because they have an atheist agenda that does not allow them. Talk about a dogma. That's their dogma, and they can't get there. But here, to me, is the issue. If consciousness survives death, and it does, then we have to be open to your Christian experience, that there is such a thing as Jesus, there is such a thing as God, there is such a thing as Buddha, and that it's in some way we don't understand. But all that seems to be the likely bet, if you will. So then at the same time, we also have to process evil and devil and however we're going to do there, Satan, you know, and I don't want to get into that and process that right now, but I'm just...
Well, let me stop you there because...
I don't think we can step back and say that... Then resort back to looking at the human experience and say, yeah, but people can get sucked into stuff and believe stuff that isn't true. Hey, we know that. Who cares? The real issue is there is an underlying truth to it that we haven't fully integrated into our society, into our thought process, or even into this conversation. The underlying reality is that there is this other spiritual dimension that is out there.
Okay, you bring up the word spiritual. One of the chestnuts I keep hearing from people in our modern age is, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. I mean, you've heard that, right?
Right.
Okay, I question the word religion for one thing. I mean, it can go in many directions. What it means to bind back to a system of belief and behavior. That's what religion essentially means. Spiritual, on the other hand, doesn't mean it's holy. Doesn't mean it's good. You can have good and bad spirits in the so-called spiritual world if you want to go there. And every experience in any religion will bring that up, whether it's Tibetan Buddhism, the Hindu faith, the Catholic faith, Jewish faith. I mean, there is something about the angel and the devil in this so-called spiritual realm. And so... You know, we can say it's real. Our near-death experiences that have been examined by some of the best minds in the world say, yeah, you know, the evidence is there. It's real. But how far does the near-death experience take one? You know, we don't know that. It may be kind of a level of another world or a heaven that is just the beginning. You know, St. Paul called this the third heaven, you know, or whatever it was.
Maybe I'm open to all that, but it seems to me that we're kind of bouncing around. The issue is that there is this other dimension to consciousness. Let's not even go with exploring it or say it's good or evil or St. Paul or any of this.
Well, I see what you're saying. Some people have really raised that. Well, you know, I understand the Skeptical Inquirer crowd, which is somewhat a wing of a humanist and atheist who is trying to reform the way we see society. He's more religious than I am in some ways, you know, so about his agenda. I understand that. I understand that crowd.
Well, you know, I wish you the best of luck with your work. Again, we'll link up to your website, and anyone who has an issue with a family member or a friend or just wants to learn more about these issues and problems that crop up with cults, I encourage them to get in touch with you. Thanks so much for joining me today, Joe.
Appreciate the talk. I enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Joe Zimmert for joining me today on Skeptico. If you'd like more information about this show, please check out the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko.com. There you'll find links to all our previous shows, an email and a Facebook link to me, and links to our forum where you can join in a conversation with other folks about this show or any of our previous shows. I've been managing to get these interviews out once a week, which is challenging on my part, but there's so many people I want to talk to, and once I talk to them, I have to publish the interview. So I don't know how long I can keep this up, but I'm sure going to try. Thanks for joining me. Make sure to tell your friends about Skeptico. Take care. Bye for now.